founders like with many different archetypes. Mark Zuckerberg, there's like the Salesforce CEO, Benioff, and sales background. I don't know if he even codes. Like there's just like so many different archetypes of a successful founder. I think the first lesson in that is like, you have to find what you're really good at. And I'm pretty sure that there's not probably infinite ways to be a really good founder. I think great founders leverage their own strengths as opposed to buying some strength that someone else has and, you know, build that thing. So knowing yourself and what you're really good at and what you're not, and then finding really great people to fill those gaps, I think a good founder does well. I think also they're just much more than the norm persistent, like almost crazily persistent. And it's a really hard balance.
Welcome to the Yale Founders Series, where we bring you in-depth interviews with Yale alumni, founders, and CEOs
to share their insights in developing and scaling avant-garde ideas.
I'm Nathaniel Johnson.
And I'm Yelena Derevyanko.
And we hope to encourage an innovative mindset
by sharing invaluable lessons from our conversations to inspire those who might be dissuaded from pursuing their entrepreneurial dreams.
In this episode, we dive into the mind of Gen Z CEO, Yale student, football player, and purpose-driven leader, Michael Chime. As a founder of Prepared, Michael passionately pursues a safer world by connecting schools and emergency services with a real-time app during crisis situations. Explore Michael's approach to vision, passion, courage, challenging conventional wisdom, and leadership as Michael shares his remarkable journey and insights. Welcome to the Founder Series. You know, I'm Nathaniel Johnson.
I'm Elena, and we're so excited to have you on and to hear how you founded Prepared and how your journey as an entrepreneur was.
Yeah, okay, let's just start off by talking about just inspiration, right? You know, this is a service that's kind of integrating with, you know, 911. It's kind of, you know, using video and audio to kind of help someone have a better sense of their surroundings, right, in danger. So I guess, what was the inspiration for creating this product?
Yeah, awesome question. So I actually started working on it 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. I was a undergrad like you guys at Yale. People ask me all the time why I built something in public safety right out of school that seemed unique and hard. And so I started there. I grew up in a town right outside of where there was an active shooter event, 2012. 2012, mm-hmm. I was super young, you know, 13, 14 years old. But it still had that impact people was. Really small blue-collar town, and I believe that was the catalyst for me. I went to college thinking about those types of problems. Yeah. And the intention was not like, hey, how do I build some big business? I'm just like, how can I build something that would help? And we started there. We built this simple app that schools would use in emergencies. And the basic idea was, you know, as opposed to a school using a walkie-talkie or PA system, we'd say, why don't you use your phone? That's a much faster, better means of communication, and everybody has one. And I think, wow, we had hundreds of schools across the country launching this simple platform. What was fascinating, though, was schools would continue to ask me the same question. You know, I'd go to school and they'd say, hey, Mike, say there was a real emergency. I would 911 give this info. Beginning, I was candid. I'm like, I don't know, just call them. But anybody just call 911. They're like, well, no, there's all this data here that I can't verbalize. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And they were talking about picture, video, and text. And again, found that fascinating. I was like, well, why would I be better equipped to communicate to my friend in this moment than I would be to 911? And that can be my worst moment. Why is that the way of the world? So remember, you know, just going in 911 centers, knocking on the door and saying, hey, I have all this data, and I'd love to give it to you. I think it's life-saving. What's the next step? And they introduced me to the problem. So despite the fact that 80, 90% of their calls are for mobile devices, the systems those centers use still to this day are built on the assumption that all the calls are landlines, and that's the way of the world. So you have this really big problem. There's 250 million 911 calls a year. Mm. And we have 90% of them. There's hundreds of millions of calls leaving life-saving data on the table. Seemed important enough that you know, stop out of school and go out and try to solve that. And so that was kind of the impetus for us building Prepared.
Amazing. It is so incredible to see how it's changing lives and impacting lives and saving lives. And can you talk more about what do you think would be the biggest challenge in developing the technology needed for Prepared?
Yeah, I think the first thing was like, so I can walk back through that journey of like, how did we begin from point A to point B? And so taking it from, hey, I was introduced to this really big problem. Next, how do we solve it? And of course, we're like, I don't know. Let's go in and try to figure that out. And I think the first challenge is on the user side, right? So if you're calling 911, you're not planning for that emergency 2 weeks in advance. So like some app native solution that you'd have to download beforehand just like didn't make sense. And so how could we get around that? How could we report it in a different way, add additional information that could be valuable without having to change that user's behavior in any way at that moment? And how could it be as frictionless as possible, right? You're in an emergency, you just need to share that data now. And so we did that via SMS. So you just, you send a text to that caller, they click on the link, and then they share their device directly in real time. We had another challenge in the actual 911 center, which is like, if they're using 80s tech right now, then maybe they're not ready to adapt to something really, really new. And that presented both technical challenge, but also adoption and some kind of training challenges. Where does this fit in to what you're doing today?
Yeah.
So the decision we made is just, we would say, you don't have to rip and replace any system you're using today. We work on top of them. So you can implement this right now. Use the system you're using now to take the call, but when you want the supplemental information, you go to us. And then the second thing is we have team members now on staff that bring 50 plus years of 911 center specific experience. So you can come in and speak to, here's when you'd use it, what's the proper time to introduce this on a call, et cetera. So I think those were the hard challenges. And then you have scale challenges too. Like now as we start to see more and more centers adopt and more incidents go to the platform, you start to consider what does that look like. And
No, it's like, it's sort of interesting too. You know, you mentioned how like you were basically putting these platforms on top of existing ones, right? There is this really cool trend, you know, even the last, like, let's say a few years of how, let's say Uber, right? They're taking cars that people already have and now you're making a system around it. Airbnb with houses around it, and then you're not prepared. Like, this is such a cool trend, I think, to
see as well. Especially when it's so hard to integrate innovation, how innovation moves rapidly into established systems, especially emergency response systems that are so established and so big.
Yeah.
Talk about how you managed to integrate the innovation technology that you guys are using into such a huge system.
Yeah, I actually think that's an interesting point that was just brought up on Uber innovating on something existing, Airbnb innovating on something existing. And I think oftentimes the people that are, or just like everyday people, when they're thinking about innovation, they go, well, I could have thought of that. That's simple, right? It's a button that I press and a car shows up. And what's often interesting is the technical solution to really hard innovation problems are often simple technically, right? Like from a pure technical perspective, they're simple solutions and they ought to be, right? They're used by real people in real moments. You actually want them to be simple. And sometimes it's complex to get something simple, but like we're no different in that, right? Like, is it worth $50 in New York City to click on a button and a car shows up? Well, it's just a button. That shouldn't be worth $50. You're not buying a button. You're buying, I couldn't go to this place before. Now I can. Right. And that's a really cool, this micro transportation problem. That's what I'm buying. And with Airbnb, it's like, I'm not buying a button in their house. I'm buying the fact that I can go and live in a place at a time that I could have never really stayed in unless I went to this hotel. And it's a totally different experience. And we're the same way, right? We're sending a link.
Yeah.
On it. Like, it opens up your browser. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing with citizens is not the kind of a link that they're clicking on. It is in their worst moments, they're able to get the best help is what we're trying to do. And conversely, it's the same thing that's true with the responder, right? They're running into a burning building and they think a lot about, will I come out? Will I see wife and kids again? Improving the odds that happens, right? And so I think that's a really interesting point, kind of aside there, if you allow me to riff for a second. Like, I just think that's
about,
because that's so true. Like, often the technical solution is really simple. And so like, well, it's just a simple thing. And it's not that, though. It's a problem in solving it. And hopefully you can solve complex problems simply. It's much easier to adjust them. But I think that second point is a really interesting one too. It's like, when you're coming in with something innovative, the hard thing is people may not be ready for that thing, for that innovation. And so I think there's actually this like curve that's interesting where you want enough friction when you're thinking about innovation that you feel it, but not too much friction. If you think about it, if you go to a space right now, you have a new solution and everybody's on board, there's probably a million competitors. That need has been, you know, kind of saturated. People know that's an established need. There's 20 million people that are trying to do. So if the market opportunity is sufficiently large, but if you're like 10 years early, people are like, no, we're not doing this. And we're not going to do it for another 5 to 10 years. So I think like oftentimes you, in the middle is where people get tripped up. You face some friction, you're like, ah, this is never going to work. But if you don't face any friction again, you're later in that curve. And so I think like what I'm trying to get at, that's an assumption of being innovative, is that if there's no friction, you're not really innovating at all. I'd say that's already established need that they identified. So we're no different in that. And I think that it is a shift for 911 vendors and cities broadly in their emergency process to ingest media information. They're an audio business. They've built everything off of just ingesting phone calls. But I think that we've seen kind of massive adoption of the tool, which makes us think that despite that friction that we're seeing, that it's the right time.
As you were saying, like, it's so interesting with all these, like, you know, you're not buying a button. I really like that. You're kind of buying the service behind it, right? I guess often with all these trends that we're seeing, like the last, you know, a few years, et cetera, like we have the recent trend of AI too. I mean, let's talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah. Do you see prepared implementing AI trends into the services that you guys are providing? Would that be more efficient?
Because yeah, like just to add on, right? Like we're talking about this one trend, you know, of kind of stacking technology in terms of existing, you know, things that people have, right? Their phone, their house, car, et cetera. And now there's just this huge marvelous trend in terms of people trying to integrate AI everywhere, right? It's almost like even just having it by itself, even if it provides almost like some minimal utility, the name, right, kind of garners more attention to it. So I guess in terms of, you know, providing, let's say, video and audio enhancement to the police, et cetera, is there like sort of integration you're looking at adding in? Or do you think this trend maybe wouldn't be applicable in this niche?
Yeah, no, I think it'll probably be the most disruptive thing since like the internet in general. AI will, early indications it looks that way, then it'll be a super disruptive force. And I think it'll touch everyone. Yeah, it's about, you know, it's really about how fast. Yeah, I think more innovative subsets or industries will adopt it faster, right? Like it'll probably go in creatives or people doing data entry, et cetera, and will feel the disruption much earlier than say government. You know? But absolutely, there's a million things that we could do. And to some respect, the AI is already being utilized every day in the public safety.
Yeah.
Like LPR cameras that you're familiar with, an LPR camera. LPR cameras are all over cities. They ping license plates in the background. If there's a stolen car, people will be notified instantly. It'll in the background put that against, you know, warrants out, et cetera. That's already happening. And so, you know, we're just another device that's being utilized in the situation where the camera is being used on phones. So there's no reason that those same innovations, if a license plate was detected by our camera, there's no reason we can't ping the same systems and let people know that that's actually a stolen car on the scene. For sure, those things will touch every space.
Yeah, absolutely. And touching back on our talk about innovation and AI, specifically because prepared in such an industry-specific niche, I guess, what is your advice for future entrepreneurs that are looking to develop solutions in a very specific niche industry?
That's probably, to start, a good thing. Like we talked a little bit about when you're innovating, the question, why is this the right time, is an interesting question. You know, like if you're too late on this, you're going to have ample competition. If you're too early, probably not going to take and you'll miss the opportunity. The same question can be applied to where you start. You know, what subset of users do you start with? And this is, I think, like an idea that people have talked about a lot deeper than I'm going to talk about right here, but like Facebook started with just college campuses on purpose. If they would have just said, hey, Facebook, anybody sign up, anyone can use this right now, they probably wouldn't have been successful. It would have been really hard to get the kind of the scale that they needed for it to be valuable with the people in the network, enough connected. The fact that you were on this isolated campus, you could interact with these people in real life and also on the internet, made it so cool, right? And so you can apply that same idea to most startups, right? If you can get a lot of penetration and movement and excitement to happen in a niche, is that we start with that one third, but we see a million different places where our thing can expand and grow.
Yeah, I remember you were mentioning at the beginning, right? You were having this system with the phone in high school, right? In terms of having this like sort of safety feature. So in that way, like, you identified a niche, right? If you'd maybe expanded to just everyone using this software, it would have maybe had a different issue in terms of scaling. I think it's such a marvelous thing. It's a unique thing to kind of find where exactly you want to pinpoint a niche to start something in, right? It could have some very broad application, but just finding something very specific, it's really complicated.
About that, what do you think are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned working with within such a specific industry?
Tons of lessons, for sure. And like, I think that specifically has really helped us. So I think it's more of a confirmation than a lesson. Like, that's probably right. It's starting with a very small subset of an industry or space is a good thing to do. You know, it has tailwinds. You know, those users all talk to one another about the things that, you know, our quickly, you know, our growth has been inbound as opposed to outbound. That's switched quickly because, you know, everybody's talking to each other about it. They want to hear more about the solution. So I think that's one lesson. I don't know if there's any specific lessons on like niche, starting in a niche, other than just like, it's good to, you probably should. It's, yeah. If you start too big, it's really hard to boil the ocean or at least solve world hunger today. If it's a big, ambitious problem, then you should probably start with, you know, solving, you know, a city's hunger before the world. It's more of a confirmation than a lesson, but it's been successful for us and many others have said the same.
From a niche, you know, you can identify the audience, you know, product market fit, all those things. You know, when you're kind of, let's jump a little bit fast forward to the next step, right? You kind of have this idea, this niche is kind of doing well with, in terms of what you're developing. Let's talk about funding for a little bit as well.
Absolutely. Part of scaling startup is huge in getting good investors to come on and fund your startup. So how, and Prepared has received funding from very prominent investors like GV and others. Can you talk about the fundraising process and any lessons that you have learned from raising capital for your company?
Yeah, and just for anyone listening, so we're Bob Series A. We've raised just under $20 million so far. The first round, you mentioned Google, the iFund, ABC, a number of investors we've raised, which has been great.
Yeah.
I give that context to say I actually don't think it is a helpful metric, but it's not a business metric. And like, I try to dispel that notion. Because I think that us as a space or community gets like very excited about funding.
Amazing.
Oh. And like, those are great. They're part of a business, but they don't, like, they're not the business. Like, that the actual, like, are you driving real value for users, revenue numbers, like those things are indicators of business. To me, it's almost like you have a sales pipeline. We get really excited about how many meetings we set or how many demos we had, and we don't actually track, you know, how many of those closed. But like that, I think funding is a space, and I think it actually changes a lot of incentives for people that are starting to really jump into a company today. And in a lot of ways, it drives the wrong behavior. Is this obsessive kind of like, well, we need to go fundraise? Yeah, the best way to raise a round, now getting into tactical advice, is to have a fantastic company, not to convince somebody you do. Right. So if you focus on the metric and say, you know, I'm just a fantastic company, I've done these things, and that's the obsessive focus, investors will come as a result of it. We almost have that backwards, where people are very, very early seeking fundraising for the validation and the excitement and the announcement that comes with it. And it almost is a secondary trying to build a great business. And so what we try to do is just look for true alignment. And that's with investors. That's with potential hires, that's with, you know, an advisor, you know, that's with any person. And we're very clear about what we are, what we're not, and where we're at and where we're not. So like, first, specific to fundraising, and I could talk, I have like a ton of thoughts on like hiring or getting your advisory board built, but specific to fundraising, I think, you know, the first thing is, again, having internal conviction that this is true, this assumption that you're texting is true. And if it's not true, you're not 100% certain that that thing is true, don't raise, right? Because it's really hard to build external conviction if you don't have internal conviction on that thing. So for us, you know, we wanted to prove that we scale out to as many known entrepreneurs as possible, and does that turn into kind of a repeatable funnel? You have to be very granular, et cetera. We're not, for our next round, we're not certain both of those things are true yet. so we're not going to raise until those things are true. Even though we could raise right now, I think we would be very, if we could be successful at raising around. So I think the tactical advice for an founder is be very clear about what are you trying to test and what does that assumption now turn into the long run, and then be obsessed about making sure it's true internally. And then once it's true, any investor who is excited about a big company will want to help you scale that thing. And the way to scale that is not only money, it's their relationships, their connections, et cetera, but they give you money too as a part of that. We've been really successful thinking about that.
You talked about how important it is to have a great vision, a great idea first, and provide great solutions and value to the clients before you start scaling up the company. Can you talk more about how your approach to scaling the business came? Once you do have that idea, how did your approach maybe change, develop over the years?
And then, yeah, just to touch upon that too, like you mentioned as well, back to the funding thing as well. You have a great company, right? Seek that first. I really like that. What metrics specifically then, I guess, in a really broad answer, could you do? Because obviously different companies use different things. You got like DAUs, et cetera. What would be like a kind of generalistic approach to evaluate, is your company, or what would you use?
Yeah, great question. And so I can touch on metrics. How do you know when you're a great company? It's a really interesting question. And I think that's complex. And then the second on how do you scale it once you have something, So I think on the first, it's company dependent, but you shouldn't kid yourself. Like if your metric should be revenue and you just track, like again, that sales funnel, like don't track demos. You should track them, but don't only track demos, right? Like and convince yourself because I'm having a ton of demos, I'm making a ton of progress. And so I think each company should go through that self-assessment and try to understand, well, what's an end state for us? Because some businesses, it's not revenue. I think revenue oftentimes is the one. You should have a really compelling answer, but it's not that if you're looking sure as a metric that we should track. But there's a lot of companies where it's not, right? Like users could be one, and daily active users that are going up. And this is just like, this is the metrics you track. There's another thing is, are you progressing toward your mission? But if I'm just talking about metrics, which is the numbers, like revenue as a first thought, and then if there's reason to, you maybe do daily active users, et cetera. Or things like in the very early days, product market fit scores. It's like Superhuman put out a really good framework with first round that says, if you're scoring above 40% on very disappointed scale. So like you send out to your users, would you be really disappointed if you rip this out? And 40% above are saying that, that's normally product market fit. So we track that. So you put these metrics together. And hopefully that starts to answer the question is, I think revenue is the main one. And then there's really good frameworks here on like, what does Series A revenue look like? What does Series B revenue look like? What is Series A? And there's absolutely companies that break this mold and they just like can raise a Series C with no revenue. It's just like, okay, they did it. Yeah. But like by and large, these are pretty good metrics to look at. And then the second question is like, how do you scale something that's working? That's almost directly related to hiring. Now I think there's an interesting time period where your company switches from what question, or the most important question is not what questions anymore, it's who questions. And who are you hiring? Who are you bringing onto the team? And when that switches over, I think scaling and hiring seem very similar. To me, or at least the biggest thing is hiring. So how do you go about hiring? I think the first thing is again, just like an investor, looking for true alignment. Like I find myself often in pitches to potential employee, pitching against the company, then for it. And like, because a startup is just different than a late stage company. And you want to weed out people that are not ready for that experience. Because it's not good for the employee and it's not good for the company. Like startup is longer hours most times because a lot of stuff's broken. And a startup is often not going to be the same base, right? It's equity. Yeah, that's a lot of times it's coming in. Yeah, and you have all these startups or not startups or not, but it's the most rewarding, but you actually solve an important problem. But there's buts after it. So I look for when scaling, you're thinking about who to hire, you look for true alignment and don't try to convince this person that this is the best thing ever and it's better than Google's salary and we're going to give you equity and all that just to get the hire in. Yeah. It almost always fails when they get in. They're like, oh, this kind of sucks. And those type of people that are attracted to that thing often don't want to roll up their sleeves and solve the hard problem. So then you just pay somebody a lot of money in stock options and you solve the problems for them,
sure.
Which nobody wants. So I I think focusing on hiring when you're scaling is critical. I've, like, thrown my hand up. I've made a million mistakes on all of these things. But to even make it more tactical, there's a good framework called the Boo Framework, which is a book that I recommend anybody scaling to read. That is like a very disciplined, how do you go about hiring the right people? We don't do everything in it because it would take forever to do the whole thing, but I recommend taking pieces of it and doing it.
Absolutely. There are so many metrics that go into not even just scaling a business, but building a great business from even before you start scaling it. Let's talk about perhaps what it takes, what metrics it takes to measure a good entrepreneur. There are so many debates, ongoing debates, what it takes to be successful in that 1% of startups that succeed.
Yeah, no, that's a great thing to mention, right? Because you can have a great company, but then it's also who's leading that company as well, right? What sort of like traits, qualities should an entrepreneur, a CEO kind of have would be likely to greatly scale a business in that sense?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I am, because there's so many different, you know, like normally when you ask a question, you'd be like, okay, how do I do X? And then you look at X thing, who's been successful at it in the past, and like, what do they look like, right? Like if you're looking at, okay, football, for example, and you're like, I want to be a great quarterback. Who are the great quarterbacks? So I can just study Tom Brady's film or, you know, somebody's film. And okay, you can work backwards and figure out how they've done well. Founders, like, many different archetypes. Like there's like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, there's like the Salesforce CEO, Benioff, sales background. I don't know if he even codes. Like there's just like so many different archetypes of a successful founder that I think it's hard to kind of with. But I think there are some consistent things. I think the first lesson in that is like, you have to find what you're really good at. And I'm pretty sure that there's probably infinite ways to be a really good founder. I think great founders leverage their own strengths as opposed to find some strength that someone else has and, you know, build that thing. So knowing yourself and what you're really good at and what you're not, and then finding really great people to fill those gaps, I think a good founder does well. I think also they're just like much more than the norm, persistent, like almost crazily persistent. Like they just, you know, like, and it's a really hard balance, right? You want to have really strong convictions that are loosely held. You want to believe this thing is true, but like be open to somebody proving it wrong. But I think like they have an end state in mind that they're very certain is a better way of the world. And like, no matter what happens, they're going to pursue it. And I think most founders that are successful are that way and are just like, it's determined, you know, like Sam Altman talks about when he meets a founder, they should be a force of nature. I think that idea is just like, I just will solve this problem, yeah, no matter what. And I think there's some truth in that. And then I think truth seeking, which is like, you know, that's that loosely held portion of it. It's like, you know, maybe that this is the end state. I'm very certain of it. But I think that starting a startup is like trying to climb Mount Everest with a blindfold. You have to take in feedback and you make these micro edits over time that are not 100% correct, but hopefully they are correct. And to do that, you need to take in information. You're dead set on going to the top, to getting to the summit, but to get there, you know, it's not exactly clear. So you're going to need to take in information to get on the right path. So I think to sum that up, it's like knowing who are you and leaning into that, and then finding people that they can counter that well, being very certain that you're going to get there at the top, but being very kind of thoughtful about how can I change quickly and edit to find that path, because there's no playbook that anyone's ever built. That's exactly what your company is. Every company is unique and different.
Absolutely. And knowing who you are, what value you can provide, what you're capable of, and what is the most efficient way to learn the things that you need to learn to achieve what you want to achieve is so important. And even if you have those great characteristics, a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs are dissuaded from pursuing starting startups just because of their fear of risk.
Yeah, no, that's a big
such
thing.
A huge thing.
We see that in a bunch of colleges even nowadays, right? People often have to strive to innovate, but often are enticed by the blessings of finance, for example, in one of our fields, especially right. Yeah, right. So yeah. I don't know, what is your advice, I guess, what would you say to those entrepreneurs who have an idea, who are, someone asked them, you know, are you an entrepreneur? Say, well, I have an idea, I'm working on something, but you know, I gotta go to this. I'm not sure if it's gonna work out. You know what I mean? They had to put. People always say entrepreneurs give it their all, right? So in that sense, when they're giving it their all, how are you gonna kind of measure if that's worth it or not?
Especially when you have much more appealing routes, much more safer routes.
Exactly, right? How do you kind of gauge in the sense, rather, even if you say that you really believe in this idea, right? It's about gauging, you know, if you're going to really take that risk and take that leap forward or stay safe.
Do you think it's more, it takes being not risk averse, or are there any other qualities that go into it?
I think this is interesting. Like, what are the conditions that lead to being a founder? And I haven't actually thought about this that much. I mean, I don't think about it on the spot. I think I'm for sure trying to give you an answer. I think I do think, like, just looking at me for a second, I probably have a less than or more than normal risk tolerance. Like, I don't think I feel fear strongly. I think it's just like I really want to do this thing, and if I didn't do this thing, then, you know, I would feel really bad about not having tried. So maybe that's an interesting way to think about it, is like, you know, over the short term, because you think about what is the other opportunity that makes me think this is less safe, right? And let's just look at those two things. In the short run, that's absolutely a more safe opportunity. But when you're 80, if you're optimizing, like Bezos talks a lot about this, if you're optimizing for regret, is that actually safer in minimizing regret? It's almost certainly not, right? Mm. Like, so the real safe option in the long run is starting that thing that you're really convinced is right, that you're going to go do, because you're going to have less risk. It's about, do you want safety in the next 5 years, or do you want safety or avoidance of regret in the next 80? And most time you want to take a long range perspective on life and then just, like, you know, not feel that regret over the long run. Well, I think another thing is,
I really like that point. I'm not going to lie. When you said the risk, like regret later, I never actually thought about that. It's really interesting because, you know, you just have people going on through, like, you know, they think it's security at the moment, but let's say there's this new technology, new trend, and all of a sudden, you know, you kind of that skill maybe you're working on would have been something.
But. Absolutely. And how many people have thought about an idea that would be so useful to somebody and be like, I don't know why nobody has ever started something like this. And then a couple of months, a couple of years later, somebody goes out and starts something that their idea was exactly centered around.
Yeah, and so I think about this a lot. Like, one of the questions we ask nearly anybody that's joining, just because I've, like, wondered whether they've joined already or they're about to join, it's just like, what do you want in 5 years?